This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Five police are killed in Dallas amid a protest over police killings elsewhere.
There's an officer down. They're moving in on somebody.
Hillary Clinton clears a legal hurdle after the FBI recommends no charges in her mishandling of classified emails, FBI Director James Comey.
Any reasonable person in Secretary Clinton's position should have known that an unclassified system was no place for that conversation.
Political hurdles remain, though. Meanwhile, the governor's race in New Hampshire starts to take shape with candidates like Republican Chris Sununu.
We're always reacting in this state to problems. I want to provide leadership that is proactive, that is pre-identifying issues.
And Democrat Colin Van Ostern casting themselves as forward-looking.
I see a future where we no longer have the lowest minimum wage in the country, which we do right now in New Hampshire. A future where no matter which town you're from or which family you're from, you have access and your kids do to things like full-day public kindergarten. You can go to great, excellent schools, graduate, and if you want, go to college without getting crushed by debt.
And whoever gets to the coroner office may have some money to spend. State revenues are now $100 million above budget, mostly due to business tax collections. Opinion differ on why. Cuts to business taxes, lowball revenue estimates, or something else. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Let's hear from you. Call into The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477 or email to theexchange@nhpr.org, Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Trent Spinner, executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Ali Moore, State House reporter for the Concord Monitor, and Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University and the website New Hampshire Political Capital. All right, so let's start with Dallas. We've all been listening to the latest from police officials there. Five officers killed in a sniper-like attack. Deadliest loss of life among law enforcement since September 11th, 2001. It came as police were observing demonstrators protesting police-involved shootings in Louisiana and Minnesota. We've heard from Dallas police officials. Why don't we take a listen to what the president said a little bit earlier?
As I told Mayor Rawlings, I believe that I speak for every single American when I say that we are horrified over these events and that we stand united with the people and the police department in Dallas. According to police, there are multiple suspects. We will learn more, undoubtedly, about their twisted motivations. But let's be clear, there's no possible justification for these kinds of attacks or any violence against law enforcement. The FBI is already in touch with the Dallas police, and anyone involved in these senseless murders will be held fully accountable. Justice will be done.
So that's President Obama speaking earlier from Warsaw, Poland, at a NATO meeting. We're going to see where the investigation of this incident in Dallas goes and obviously what we learn about the attackers. But more broadly, and I guess I'll put this question to you, Dean, this incident and the shootings in Louisiana and Minnesota would only seem to thicken some already pretty tough debates in this country: guns, policing, treatment of African Americans by police.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, it's been a tragic couple of days, as you mentioned, with the shootings in Baton Rouge and Minneapolis, and now this ambush of the police in Dallas. And you're right. You know, this issue of officer-involved shootings is something that's been very visible in the public in recent years. There was a sense among a lot of people who were involved in this issue that there was starting to be some progress in the relationship between law enforcement and the affected communities over time. Now this really kind of roils the whole situation and really raises a lot of questions. And, you know, I think initially people will probably just sort of step back and take a deep breath, both in law enforcement and in the communities that are upset about the shootings. But the reality is there is a very complex political overlay to this. It's geographical, it's racial, it's political. It involves debates about gun control issues about the economy and opportunity in inner cities. It's a very complex debate, and it probably won't be long before that is fired up again. But there's no doubt it's been just a terrible couple of days, just when it seemed like some of these sort of underlying tensions were being addressed around the country, really over the last year or so.
Well, one aspect of the shooting in Minnesota where a man named Philando Castile was killed after a traffic stop was that Castile apparently was armed and had a permit to carry a concealed weapon. Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton has said that he didn't think Castile would have been shot if he were white. But in addition to race, you know, there is this concealed carry aspect of the case that is interesting and certainly an ongoing debate here in New Hampshire for 2 years running now. Lawmakers have tried to eliminate gun permits, and Governor Hassan has veto those bills. Do you expect that this issue is going to come back next year, Allie? You've covered this.
It's come up over several years, and I anticipate it will come back again. You know, it seems like gun control issues change depending on who's in charge of the legislature. And, you know, I think we've seen over the last 2 years with Republicans in charge, they've made some comments that actually the concealed carry laws have been discriminatory against people, the police, because they have so much or they have say over who is suitable to carry a concealed carry license, that they can use that discretion widely, and some people actually say they're discriminated against. And so I think that's something Republicans were pushing this year to try to take away that suitable language and make the concealed carry process, in their eyes, a little bit more fair. On the other side, Democrats say, you know, we need some sort of decision-making around who gets these concealed carry permits because we don't want guns to end up in people's hands, in the wrong people's hands. So, you know, I think this might add fuel to that fire, but I don't see that debate going away, you know, in New Hampshire anytime soon.
Well, you know, another part of this that's interesting is that, you know, New Hampshire has certainly had its share of officer-involved shootings. And, you know, this morning's union leader, Trent Dave Solomon, has a big story about how the New Hampshire Attorney General's office handles the release of information on police involved, what they call use of force incidents. The Federal Department of Justice has urged authorities to release information on officers involved in 72 hours. That's decidedly not the approach taken in New Hampshire. Your paper's got the story, Trent. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, we wanted to take a look at that. In yesterday's Union Leader, I read the story about the shooting, police-involved shooting in Louisiana, and I saw that both of the officers' names were in that story, and I saw the United States Department of Justice urging their release. And I just want to take a look at why the United States Department of Justice does it differently than the New Hampshire Department of Justice. And so we went back over the last 3 years, and our front page has a fantastic graphic looking at all the fatal police-involved shootings over the last 3 years. And what you'll see is that there are some cases where names of police officers weren't released for 176 days, for 72 days, for 216 days in one particularly complicated case. And we're also following a story out of Nashua where, a television news helicopter captured what appeared to be a police officer punching a man on the ground with his hands up. And that's been 58 days since we found out which police officers were involved, which officers were involved. So we wanted to take a look and we wanted to ask the Attorney General's office, why do you do it different than the United States Department of Justice? And what they say is they've got one chance at this. Police-involved shootings are incredibly difficult cases. When they arrive on scenes, there are all kinds of different stories. And as, you know, reporters here know, you show up and people are saying one thing and other people are saying another thing. And it really depends on your vantage point. And the Attorney General's office says, look, we get one chance at this and we have to get it 100% right. And sometimes that takes time. A lot of times that takes time.
Some would say that, well, that's a noble goal, but that that's a goal that presumably, authority share in getting the bottom of all shootings. But the degree of diligence taken to not prematurely, in their estimation, reveal information about law enforcement certainly surpasses the attitude taken towards everyday citizens involved.
That's absolutely right. And in our story, we have people who say, you know, this is part of the problem. This is what kind of creates this divide between police and civilians, is that people feel like the police are being treated differently. If a regular civilian was involved in some sort of homicide, their name, their mugshot would be released. In police-involved shootings, at least in the last 3 years, police haven't been found at fault for any of them. So it's different. I mean, they're not being charged with a crime, obviously. Um, but But that's the complaint, is that why are police officers being treated differently in New Hampshire?
Well, and if you look at the record going back years, and it's something that Ali's paper has covered well through the years, is just documenting, you know, the volume of police shootings. And as somebody who receives the press releases from the Attorney General's office, you know, they tend to conclude with, you know, finding of no fault on the part of the officer. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see where this sort of thing goes in a climate where there's greater scrutiny of law enforcement behavior.
Yeah, the other big difference here, I think, in comparison to in the past, even going back several decades, is the impact of technology. You know, there's an issue of whether or not are officer-involved shootings happening more frequently now than in the past? Not necessarily, but we're seeing and learning about them in a completely new way, which sort of raises the bar in terms of evidence collection and getting the story correct. I mean, just the quantity of video for all three of these incidents that just happened, both in, you know, Minnesota and Baton Rouge and now Dallas. You know, before I went to bed last night, I looked on Twitter and there was live footage of automatic weapons fire. Couldn't see what was happening, but you knew something really bad had just happened in Dallas. And then, you know, we saw the shooting that the girlfriend of the gentleman killed in Minneapolis went live talking about what had just happened. I mean, it's just a remarkable look at, and it's been the case for a number of the officer-involved shootings in recent months, and it's fundamentally changing the stakes for law enforcement to get it right, because there's this sort of independent way to kind of verify a lot of what they're saying.
Well, independent, and, you know, obviously body cams on law enforcement are an issue that has been something that's been debated in Concord. I know you've written about this, Ali. I mean, where does the state stand on this? And, you know, have you seen attitudes shift over the past year on this?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see how the state does harness this technology to try to move forward with body cameras. We saw a bill 2 years ago that would have mandated all state police wear body cameras. That was quickly changed once we realized, you know, the cost that would carry. And I think there's still a push among some lawmakers that they do want to have troopers and other police wear body cameras. The bill that passed this year would set state guidelines for how they're used, because obviously when you start recording in intense situations, if you're interviewing a victim, if you're going into a private residence, what might you capture on film that then might be subject to right-to-know laws? So that was sort of a tricky process. That bill passed. And, you know, I've talked to state police recently, and what they're actually doing is they're shifting more towards dash cams. About a third of cruisers in the state police force now have a dash cam, and they're trying to expand that program as opposed to putting body cameras on their police. What I think will be interesting is I believe in the Minnesota case that we've been talking about, there was a dashboard cam, and I wonder how much footage that would have caught, given that the officers were on either side of the car looking in. You know, I think it'll be interesting to see what type of video a dash cam provides in that situation and what could have been collected perhaps with a body camera instead.
Okay.
And there's a real debate between dash cams and body cameras. We had two police-involved shootings in the last 3 years. One involved a dash cam and one involved a body camera. The dash camera was in the north end of Manchester. This woman, Wendy Lawrence, led police on a high-speed chase down 93. Police kind of blocked her in, so they were perpendicular with her. And so the dash cam was not facing her car. And police said that she kind of went forward towards officers, and that's when they opened fire. But that was not captured on video because it was a dash cam and it wasn't facing her. It wasn't facing her car at the time. And then last year we had the fatal police shooting in Bath where Hagen Etsy Lennon was captured on body camera running at police with a knife in his hand. And I remember in the newsroom when the first time we watched that video, we said if we were those police officers, there'd really be no other way to handle this situation. And I think that's part of I think that the body cameras really help build public trust in the officers' actions. In the Bath shooting, it was so clear what happened. Anyone who watched the video would understand why officers used lethal force. But with the dash cameras, if they're not pointed in the exact right direction, you can miss everything.
I mean, the body cameras issue is, having attended some of the debates at the State House over this, I mean, it's complicated. And there was a bill that was set up to determine when you could have it on, when you could have it off. You're supposed to have it on when you were doing essentially official police things. You couldn't use it in certain questioning circumstances or in a school. And, you know, some local police forces have adopted them. But, you know, there is the data storage issues. And, I guess we'll see where this goes. One other issue here, though, is that it's obviously a very difficult and, you know, you hear this if you talk to police and just listening to the police chief in Dallas talk about, you know, with great pride, strides he says his department's made to use less confrontational means of policing, and that sometimes the sort of militarization of police, the availability of technology can lead to situations being, you know, perhaps prematurely escalated. It's obviously very difficult in the moment. Do you think we're going to hear much talk in New Hampshire? I mean, we've had some of these shootings in New Hampshire have taken place in, you know, small areas. We still don't, you know, this is pointed out in the article in the Union Leader that we still don't have really any information about the shooting that took place in Peterborough, late last month.
Now, 17 days ago.
Yes. And, where this is going to go, quote in the article, Chuck Douglas, lawyer, former Supreme Court justice and congressman, said that, you know, in his estimation, it's public employee, public information. Jane Young says it's not the popular course, but we've learned what is best. It's a pretty stark difference of opinion.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I think it's very important to understand just how difficult it is to be a police officer, how difficult it is to be a police officer in Manchester. I've done ride-alongs, and some of the stuff that I've seen is shocking and really puts all of this in perspective. In the last few years, we've seen 4 police officers either killed or injured in the line of duty in Manchester. And that, to me, is just shocking that happened, even on the west side a few weeks ago with two Manchester police officers injured, shot. But it is a debate about how much information should be public, what the best practices are, and the best way to make sure that the public has the information that they feel like they need to feel confident in their police force.
And the demilitarization of police forces that you mentioned, that's been a big issue in New Hampshire, primarily around the issue of cities and towns acquiring these surplus Bearcats, which are these armored vehicles. I mean, this goes all the way back to the conflict in Ferguson and the belief there that the police force was overly militarized in the way they handled it. That's an ongoing debate as well. I mean, Trent is right. It's a very difficult, dangerous job to be in law enforcement, and it seemed, as we were discussing, that there had been some progress between the law enforcement community and communities that believe that they're not being policed fairly or safely, and we'll see what comes out of this. Maybe it'll move the debate forward a little bit, but we probably haven't seen the end of these kinds of tragedies on both sides.
Unfortunately, no. Coming up, we'll hear more on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a minute on NHPR. But do call us at 1-800-892-6477 or email Facebook. We'll take your calls after the break. Coming up, more of the New Hampshire Weekly News Roundup on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. You can join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. We've getting some calls. Why don't we take a call? I guess we're not going to take a call. So, why don't we move on away from Dallas and towards the presidential campaign trail? It looks like on Tuesday, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are going to be here, sort of bearing the hatchet or coming together after a long primary season, sort of reminiscent of potentially of the event that then nominee Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton had in Unity. That was a town where, of course, they tied in votes. The symbolism was rife. It was very difficult to get to, as anyone has ever driven to Unity, apparently. That event was sprung from the mind of now Governor Maggie Hassan. For the record, Bernie Sanders carried Unity over Clinton with some ease. Don't think they're going to be in Unity. You know, obviously it's been a tough week for Hillary Clinton. Some of her supporters would say, you know, heaving a sigh of relief, but not being, you know, a week in which a candidate is the good news is you're not being charged, you know, might still be tough. Dean, what do you think? Yeah. What do you think comes out of this week?
Yeah. And there's she's had a very difficult week with the FBI director releasing the results of the study, even though she's not going to be indicted. There's certainly a lot of fodder there for her opponents. And I think she still has a lot of questions to answer. They're kind of laying low right now. And I think to some extent, obviously, this Dallas shooting combined with some other kind of campaign missteps by the Trump campaign have sort of given her a little temporary break. But at some point, whether it's the fall debates or some other longer form interviews where she'll have to kind of go back and discuss some of these results. And, you know, my guess is the House Republicans are not going to let it go either. They're talking about now investigating whether she lied under oath when she testified for Benghazi previously. So, you know, what is this all about, this unity meeting? Well, you know, Bernie Sanders has wanted to maximize his impact on the Democratic platform in advance of the Democratic convention in a few weeks. And that platform was being ironed out this week. And, you know, he wanted some things in there. They got opposition to the death penalty, which is sort of different than Hillary Clinton's position. $15 minimum wage, I think. Hillary Clinton also proposed earlier this week free public university tuition for families with below $125,000 income. That seemed to make Bernie Sanders very happy. So on the one hand, he's kind of getting some of what he wants on the platform committee. It's a very progressive platform. On the other hand, he went and talked to the House Democratic Caucus the other day, and some Democrats booed him. And we're asking him repeatedly about his timeline for getting in line behind the candidate. So I think the pressure was on him. He doesn't want to overplay his hand, but he was basically holding out until he got what he could get out of the platform. And now we should have this sort of moment next Tuesday where he'll probably endorse her.
And so, Trent, what do you – you know, obviously polling throughout the primary here and since has suggested that, you know, voters in New Hampshire and voters across the country believe that, you know, Hillary Clinton may have the best qualifications to be president, but they also believe that she was the least trustworthy candidate in the Democratic field. You know, what do you think this email, the finding by FBI Director Comey that, you know, she obviously handled the emails carelessly, but they couldn't find any specific intent to do anything that would lead to criminal charges?
Here's what I think. I think people have made up their mind already whether or not they're going to support Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. I was at an event with probably 400 or 500 people in Boston. I was up on the stage and I just asked everyone, I said, can everyone in this audience just listen to me for 1 second and pay attention?
Where were you speaking?
It was the UMass Boston like campus center. And it was a conference of PR folks and, you know, a lot of professionals from around New England. And I said, just pay attention. Everyone, put down your phones. Just I have one question for the audience. Can you all, everyone who's undecided between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, there are 400, 500 people there. Can you please raise your hand? 4 people raised their hand. And I think that is pretty fair. I think that is a pretty accurate representation of at least New England, New Hampshire, but I would also say the country, that people have already decided whether or not they're going to support Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. They're going to say, you know, Donald Trump is X, but I still support him, or Hillary Clinton is Y, but I still support her. And I think that this email issue is not going to be a huge deal for her. That said, I also want to talk about what happened in the New Hampshire primary and Hillary Clinton's issue with optics. You remember she was winning New Hampshire by something like 45% of the vote in the very early polls. She came to New Hampshire. She didn't immediately take any questions from people, which I think caused some friction between the campaign and the press and eventually the public. And then there was that rope line incident in, I want to say it was Conway, where she was walking through a July 4th parade and they put up a rope line around her so that the press couldn't get close to her. And I just think that the Clinton campaign, at least early on, messed up the optics. And so you cannot underestimate how important that can be to the electorate. So as much as I don't think the email issue is a huge deal, and I think people have already made up their minds, you can never underestimate just how much this race can change.
Well, it is hard to know whether this is the issue of accessibility to the press is something that reporters complain about and the general public cares nothing about. But, you know, for the record, it's my understanding that Secretary Clinton hasn't had a proper press conference since you know, before Christmas.
I think the Washington Post now has a countdown clock, like a time clock for how long it's been, something like 215 days, roughly, over 200 days.
But so why do you think she and Senator Sanders are coming to New Hampshire? It's, you know, putative swing status come fall, the fact that it's next to Vermont, the fact that it could lift other Democrats, all of the above.
Well, I think that there's – if you look at the Clinton campaign, there's a lot of New Hampshire connections. Robbie Mook, her campaign manager, who was really the person – Robbie Mook was really the person from the Clinton campaign who is trying to broker this endorsement. And so he's been up to – and it's been widely reported that he's been up to Burlington. He ran Gene Shaheen's campaign, so he's very familiar with New Hampshire. So I think there's that New Hampshire connection. But then the union leaders, Kevin Landrigan reported today – it's great to be able to say that – reported that it's actually kind of strange that they're coming to New Hampshire because there's no unity. Back in 2008, you know, Obama and Hillary split the vote in unity. But he reported that the vote in unity in New Hampshire this time around was 201 for Sanders and 67 for Clinton. So and he says in today's paper, there's really no unity in New Hampshire. So it's kind of unclear what exactly
part,
they're going to do.
Part of the issue is just it's just a difference in temperament and personality. Hillary Clinton, if you look back over her history as a U.S. senator, secretary of state, that in the wake of her loss to Obama in 08, she's always been very much of a team player, kind of sort of figuring out her role and kind of looking forward, whereas Sanders has very much been an outsider. He's very sort of iconoclastic, a bit of a gadfly, not super popular in Congress among some of his colleagues because of this. So, you know, there's been some criticism that he is sort of been basically sort of holding out too long and it's becoming counterproductive. But I think it's just part of the problem is they're just fundamentally different types of politicians.
Allie?
Yeah, I mean, I think New Hampshire was such a big boost to Clinton in her 2008 campaign. And I think, you know, it could be part of an effort to kind of win back the loyalty of the state. You know, New Hampshire was critical to her then. And I think what's been interesting is we've seen Donald Trump already come here twice in the last month. You know, this is her first trip back here. And, you know, maybe it indicates that New Hampshire might be a player battleground state this time around. I just want to go back to something Trent said about how people had already decided. I don't know that I'm totally on board with that statement. I hear from Republicans regularly, you know, they're really wringing their hands about whether they'll vote for Donald Trump. I don't know that many are seriously considering voting for Hillary Clinton, but that's something that they, you know, threaten often, like people, you know, moving to Canada if the candidate of their choice doesn't win. But I also think, too, that Bernie supporters are, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see at this rally next week or whatever event it ends up becoming how they embrace Hillary Clinton and if they even do. Because I think, you know, one thing, maybe people have decided who they're going to vote for, but if people aren't excited about the candidate, I think it might make them less likely to actually show up for the election come November.
Well, I think it also remains to be seen as far as the Sanders support and what he did in the primary, which was pretty remarkable, is that it's really hard to see traces of those folks in the candidates that are running for major office as Democrats. You know, it's hard to know what they're going to do come fall. And obviously this is a, you know, New Hampshire's going to have tight races. I mean, it's going to, the U.S. Senate race is huge, open seat for governor, whether or not the people that, you know, are perceived to be, and I think that the argument that Trump and Sanders necessarily brought so many new people in is probably oversold a little bit, but where those people are going to go come fall could have implications, you know, up and down the ticket.
Well, and I think if you look back to the primary, there were all these people who said, I'm going to vote for Sanders or I'm going to vote for Trump or I'm going to vote for Kasich or I'm going to vote for Trump. And to them, you know, these independent New Hampshire voters, to them, that was a real choice. But I think in the last few months, what's developed is something completely different than what we saw in the primary. And I think that we've seen Sanders say that part of this campaign, part of my campaign, was about defeating Trump and that he'll do whatever it takes to make that happen, which is why I think this Clinton endorsement is happening and is happening in New Hampshire. So I think that the electorate has changed, that people have started to make up their minds. I know we always like to talk about New Hampshire voters always deciding late, but I'm not entirely sure that's the case. I don't think there are a huge number of people who are trying to decide between Clinton and Trump.
But down ticket, you know, let's talk a little bit about the Senate race. That's, you know, taken on a slightly more truculent tone of late. You know, we have fundraising numbers which suggest that Governor Hassan slightly outraised Senator Ayotte, you know, in this last period of time. Dean, how meaningful do you think that is or not in an age when so much of the spending on elections comes from outside groups?
Yeah, we do know that a large portion of the spending in these big statewide races nowadays typically comes from these outside groups, and it's much more difficult for the campaigns to control the message as a result. Because of sort of the various laws and regulations about coordinating with these outside PACs. This is clearly a very hard-fought race. You know, the fundraising numbers are close. You know, Kayla Ayotte's been able to raise money since 2010, and she's raised about $14 million. But Governor Hassan, who started raising in October, has been closing the gap a bit. And in terms of cash on hand, Ayotte has about $7 million and Hassan has $4.2 million. So Ayotte's still ahead, and she's reserved something like $9 million in advertising through Election Day. I think Hassan is more in sort of the $6 million range. So there are some differences. We'll see the impact of these outside groups in terms of leveling that. You know, in terms of the top of the ticket, two very different positions. Maggie Hassan has been a strong supporter of Hillary Clinton for a long time, and so a very different position than Kelly Ayotte, who's sort of keeping Donald Trump at a very far arm's length. Trump met with the Capitol Hill, went and met with the Senate Republican caucus. I think Kelly Ayotte was maybe one of four Republicans who didn't show up for that and was not there. So she's just in a very different position in terms of using the power of the top of the ticket to give you a bit of a boost.
Well, I mean, certainly Hassan's fundraising numbers do suggest that her, you know, sort of out-of-state travel may be paying off in terms of campaign contributions. You know, there are indications that the Senate Majority PAC, PACs affiliated with Mitch McConnell, have reserved, you know, tranches of airtime deep into the election. And there are those who believe that, you know, senators in tight races such as Senator Ayotte may be the beneficiary of money from big Republican donors who were turned off by Donald Trump. And, I mean, to the degree to which, you know, candidates like Kelly Ayotte, Rob Portman in Ohio, you know, Mark Kirk in Illinois can kind of you know, somehow inoculate themselves against Trump, the bad parts of Trump electorally, you know, it's going to be a big question about what happens with the majority of the U.S. Senate.
It's going to be a huge question. And just going back, tying in your last question about outside money, we're going to be looking at a race that will cost somewhere between $80 and $100 million, all told, between all the outside money and the campaigns and everything like that. The campaigns may be a quarter, maybe a third of that. So just to put in perspective, almost two-thirds or three-quarters of money spent on this Senate race will come from outside of the campaigns. This is going to be a huge – and I think it's going to be a bloodbath, first of all. I think if anyone was concerned about negative advertising during the New Hampshire primary, just wait till you see what happens during the Senate race. I think it's going to be very ugly, and that's because it is so close. And to answer your more recent question, I think that's because a lot of people are looking at New Hampshire – as one of the places in the country that will decide the future of the Senate. And I think that people are going to be willing to spend a whole lot of money here to affect the outcome.
Just by way of comparison, I think the Shaheen-Scott Brown – Shaheen's reelection bid, I think that was about a $55 million race. And then when Shaheen won her first time against John Sununu, I think that was about a $35 million race. So you can just see it's ratcheting up pretty significantly every few years.
It's a great time to own a TV station in New Hampshire.
All right. But, you know, to shift to a race that's slightly lower profile, I mean, you know, the governor's race, you know, continues apace. And that is typically, I mean, in a non-presidential year, it's often the governor's race that really sort of sets the tone for what happens up and down the ballot. Not sure that situation applies this year, but, you know, what do we see there? I mean, you know, do you see candidates getting any particular purchase at this point, or everyone's still trying to introduce themselves? And
I think that the turnout for the presidential race is what will decide most of the down ticket races in New Hampshire, especially governor, where you have you don't have that many people paying attention to the race yet. I think that if Donald Trump pulls in somewhere in the 30s in terms of voters here in New Hampshire, you're going to be looking at a very Democratic state government. I think if he does similar to how McCain or Romney did, you'll be looking at kind of something similar we have now. But I think a lot of it, the governor's race, the House, and the New Hampshire Senate races will really depend on how Donald Trump does in New Hampshire.
But even before we get to November, I mean, we have a primary in 2 months. And I think what's been interesting is that there are so many candidates on both sides. I mean, there's 4 Republicans, there's 3 Democrats. Most of them were largely unknown by anyone here, you know, as they start running. And I think, you know, when you have that many candidates, it's tough, you know, for any of them to break ahead or really make movement on an issue when you're not only dealing with 2 or 3 other people in your own party, but then 3 more people on the other side. And so I think it's made it an interesting race, and candidates are sort of throwing out different issues that they want to focus on, but there's yet to be kind of a robust debate among all of them about one particular issue. You know, we've heard legalizing marijuana, a death penalty debate, economy on substance abuse, but there has yet to be kind of a level platform of here are the issues that we're all going to talk about and compare each other on the topics.
Well, I mean, obviously the rule of thumb in a primary is that you know tend to hew more towards the, you know, what's perceived to be the base of your party, and you can certainly see in the Democratic side some, you know, modest bit of, you know, sparring, I guess you'd call it, between Colin Van Ostern and Steve Marchand over who's the most progressive candidate. You mentioned Steve Marchand's opposition to the death penalty and calling for legalization of marijuana. You know, on the Republican side, you know, Jeanie Forrester and Frank Edelblue are sort of trying to stake out the role of the most conservative. You know, Chris Sununu's Planned Parenthood vote was interesting and sort of potentially complicating his situation in the primary, but, you know, may stand him in good stead with the general electorate should he get through. But, I mean, you know, is it reasonable to expect that, like, what we're going to get out of the primaries are, you know, the candidates who sort of hew most closely to the core of their party, Dean?
Yeah, there's something to be said for that strategy. I think in a lot of other election years, this would be a much more high-profile kind of race. I think it is a little more complicated by the fact that there's still so many candidates. That'll obviously change in September after the primaries. Yeah, you know, certainly on the Democratic side, but that's my expectation, is that there will be kind of an alignment between Hillary Clinton, Maggie Hassan, and you know, whoever the winner of the Democratic primary is. The Republican side is obviously a little more complicated, given sort of the mixed feelings about Trump as the nominee. But nonetheless, that's a pretty standard strategy. I do think Trent is probably right that much of this will be driven by the margins, the party margins on each side.
All right. Coming up, more of the New Hampshire's top stories in our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR after the break. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or on Facebook and Twitter. With me this morning are executive editor of the Union Leader, Trent Spinner, State House reporter of the Concord Monitor, Ali Morris, Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University, and the website NH Political Capital. So it's not all politics, but we'll turn to something that touches, you know, what is allegedly the top issue, the top concern of voters, which is the opioid crisis in New Hampshire. We had some sort of incremental developments on that front. Why don't we start with a federal change that will have real implications here in New Hampshire about treatment of addicts, you know, lifting a threshold on the number of patients that can be treated with Suboxone. Do you want to explain that, Ali?
Yeah, sure. So Suboxone is one of several drugs that doctors use to help wean people addicted to heroin or fentanyl off those illegal substances. And, you know, advocates here say it's an area that could be really grown in New Hampshire. There's not a lot of doctors that actually prescribe these drugs to people who may need it. And those who do have a wait list. And so advocates here have said, you know, we should really beef up this side because it can be helpful to put people on drugs like Suboxone and then get them some outpatient treatment that can sometimes be more effective than sending them to a bed. And so what this federal change would do would increase the number of patients that a doctor can be working with to prescribe Suboxone from, I believe, about 100 people to 275. And so I think advocates are excited that this could, you know, really allow more people to get access to this help who may need it, you know, at a time when last year, you know, more than 400 people died of drug overdoses. That number just keeps rising year after year. And so this type of medically assisted treatment, I think people see as sort of the way of the future here for drug treatment.
That's an interesting point, because you talked to a lot of people who are close to this issue, and they will say that, you know, attitudes, sometimes even within the medical profession, about treatment of people with opioid dependency hasn't really caught up to the science, and that you know, this threshold that was set low because Suboxone, it does, you know, it can be, there is a black market for some of this stuff that this is an example of that. I mean, you know, what do you see? I mean, as somebody who's, you know, paper is based in Manchester, obviously this is a huge issue there. I mean, what do you think this is going to mean, Trent?
Well, I think that people – we're at the point in this epidemic where people are really grasping for any possible solution. There are not enough beds. There are not enough treatment centers. There's just not enough help to make this happen, to make it happen. And so people are looking for any kind of solution. And you really need several solutions. You need several things happening at the same time. Suboxone has its problems. In some other states – there's an illicit cash market, both for patients to get into treatment centers or to see doctors who use Suboxone, who are federally licensed to deliver Suboxone, and you see a black market for it. So it's not by any means the silver bullet in New Hampshire or in Manchester, but it's part of the overall solution. And because we're at that point where anything that helps could possibly lower the death toll of the epidemic. I think it's a positive sign that we're going up from. We have about 200 doctors in the state who are. You have to have a federal license to administer Suboxone. So this is going to more than double the number of patients who can be seen, and I think that's a positive thing.
I mean, another good thing for people seeking treatment or for people concerned about those seeking treatment is, you know, an expansion of a number of Medicaid recipients who are now eligible for substance abuse disorder benefits. I mean, you know, it's a push and pull here, Dean, but do you think, you know, 140,000 people, that's, you know, a significant number?
Yeah, it's up from 49,000. You know, we had the Medicaid expansion. We had about 50,000 people enroll in that. Those folks had access to these substance abuse disorder benefits. That's now been expanded to all regular Medicaid recipients. And we've talked many times on the roundup about the overlap in the communities, people who need drug treatment, people who also for economic reasons need access to Medicaid benefits. So it is one aspect and an important aspect of addressing the larger issue.
Well, another overlap is the overlap between people with substance abuse issues and people with mental health issues, and that's obviously an issue that the state, you know, has been attempting to address for some time and is going to be continued to attempt to address for some time. There was an opening of a 10-bed crisis unit at long last at the state hospital. You know, what's your take on what this is going to mean, Allie?
Yeah, definitely. So this 10-bed crisis unit at New Hampshire Hospital is really meant for people to come in short term and to take stress off emergency rooms around the state where people in mental health crisis often wait for days, sometimes more than a week, trying to get into New Hampshire Hospital, which is the state-run psychiatric center in Concord. And, you know, this had been delayed because they couldn't find enough nurses for a whole year. It had been delayed, the opening. And, you know, I talked to some mental health professionals who say this is great. You know, we need more beds to help people with mental health issues. But at the same time, there's been this labor dispute at New Hampshire Hospital, which has put, you know, Dartmouth Hitchcock in charge of the medical staff there. But, you know, several psychiatrists left as a result of the change. And so to staff New Hampshire Hospital, Dartmouth Hitchcock had to pull some of its psychiatrists down from Lebanon. And as a result, 9 beds up there are now temporarily closed. And so some mental health workers are saying, well, you know, in the great scheme of things, this is really a 1-bed gain when you consider adding 10 in Concord, removing 9 in Lebanon. You know, where did this really get us? So I think that we still have a long way to go. And, you know, I know the wait lists at New Hampshire Hospital are a big concern among a lot of people. You know, the last place that someone who is having a mental health crisis needs to be, people say, is sitting in an empty room, in an emergency room for days at a time. So I think this is something people are now really aware of and will only – people will be trying to fix it going forward.
And when the state reached a settlement with people suing over insufficient mental health services, you know, court appointed an observer to this, and they were out with a report this week suggesting that, you know, New Hampshire is lagging a bit in terms of complying with the terms of the settlement, and that, you know, absent corrective action, there could be further sanctions. You know, we'll see what comes out of that. But, you know, why is this? I mean, is this simply a matter of money, Dean? I mean, why is it so hard to move on?
It's a function of infrastructure. It's a function of financial resources. It's a function of the ability to build new infrastructure quickly. You mentioned this lawsuit. The settlement was in 2014. And the idea there was for the state to provide more in-community-based mental health services so that you don't simply continue to institutionalize people at the hospital or elsewhere who maybe don't need to be there, so that you can free up those beds for people who are really in a short-term crisis. So it's been an ongoing problem. You know, it's been wrapped up in gubernatorial and state legislative politics about, you know, how much who pays for this, how much to spend, and it just seems like we just aren't quite able to catch up. That the issue with the state hospital, I mean, really is remarkable. You open up 10 new beds and you close 9 in Lebanon. So sort of that net gain of one bed is problematic, even if having the beds in Concord in some way allows for a little bit of a release valve on people who are waiting in that region. But, you know, there's a big facility up at Dartmouth-Hitchcock in the Upper Valley.
Well, there's been a back and forth between Governor Hassan and Republicans,
right,
in the State House over the opening of those 10 beds, and whose fault is it that it was late, and who didn't anticipate that you had to pay staff X to, and was the money there? And everybody talked to them, and everybody's pretty sure that it's not their fault. You know, Allie, you've heard all this. Where do you think this is going to go?
I mean, I think going back to the report, you know, I spoke to some people at community mental health centers this week, and they do say a big part of it is funding. You know, at New Hampshire Hospital, because of budget cuts, there have been beds closing over the years. And, you know, people say that's putting pressure on the wait list. And I think it might be, you know, this year we saw with substance abuse, so many people were dying. You know, voters say this is a top issue, that they know people who are addicted to heroin or who have overdosed. You know, I think as more and more people see the effects of mental health and what types of weights people have to have, that just increases the pressure on lawmakers to come up with some sort of fix, whether that's adequately funding it or, you know, passing laws to make it more accessible for people.
Trent?
And it's not just a political issue. It's not just a money issue. But nationwide, there's a shortage of mental health professionals, and that has been a major problem for New Hampshire. These are not easy jobs. Working in the state hospital is very physical. You know, there are a lot. There's a lot of there's criteria that you need to meet. This is not some sort of entry level job that you can hire a nurse or a doctor out of medical school or nursing school. These are experienced people who have expensive and difficult have gone through expensive and difficult training. And all across the country, we are seeing a shortage. Cheshire Medical Center had to shut down their psychiatric unit a few months ago because they just could not find anyone who could work there. They used national recruiting firms. They used local recruiting firms. They're partnered with Dartmouth Hitchcock too. They tried using their network, and they just were not able to find mental health professionals to work at Cheshire Medical Center, and they ended up having to close their psychiatric unit. That was 18 beds, and that same is going. The same thing is happening at the state hospital. They're struggling to find qualified people who have gone through the training, have the experience, and are willing to work in this field.
Well, I don't know how many of you drive up Clinton Street with any regularity, but it struck me that for a while there was this illuminated billboard, essentially like now hiring, state hospital medical personnel.
They have literally tried to do everything that they can to find qualified people to work in these jobs, and it's very difficult to do.
Well, one thing that may, you know, provide some lubrication to finding those sorts of people, at least at the state level, is, you know, seemingly boom times for the state coffers. It's been, some time since the state was seemingly as flush as it is. I mean, the latest reports are that state revenues are $100 million over projection. Obviously, this comes in the wake of cuts to business taxes that Republicans said were essential to getting the state on the right track, that Maggie Hassan sort of hemmed and hawed over and then vetoed the budget over not having safeguards. She was concerned about it blowing a hole in the budget. You know, the money's coming in. Under the budget of the past, there are going to be more business tax cuts that will be triggered by the revenue situation. I mean, where do you see this? I mean, what are you hearing, Ali? I mean, you look at Twitter and there's kind of sniping back and forth between people, Republicans saying, see, I told you, Democrats saying, well, you know, we told you you were lowballing revenue estimates. You know, do you think this is going to be a big debate when the new legislature returns?
You know, I think it remains to be seen, you know, how much of a role the business tax cuts play. A lot of people are chalking it up to that and bringing in new business. I think the bigger debate will be over, you know, now that these revenues are in, what are we going to do with them? And, you know, I think it's important to point out that the legislature this year has been earmarking some of this money already to services. You know, they use some of it to pay for police standards and training, some of it to pay for drug courts and other substance abuse issues. And they passed a bill that could send, you know, up to $40 million of that to the Rainy Day Fund. So I think when it's all said and done, you know, we won't actually see how much. This is just revenue. We won't actually see whether there's a surplus until later this fall. But, you know, I think people who are cheering now and saying, great, let's put this money out into the communities may have to take a step back and say, wait, how much do we actually have here? And I think it's far less than $100 million.
Yeah, the issue is finding out what the ultimate surplus is going to be in the fall, and this will certainly be part of the campaign. And my guess is there'll be debates between those Republican and Democratic candidates for governor about what you do with these business taxes and whether they can be brought back up a little bit if you're a Democrat or if you're a Republican to continue to have these cuts. But it is interesting to read. This is kind of a classic ideological debate over you know, who gets credit. And where this additional money is coming from.
When you talk to economists or people who are expert in budgetary matters, and, you know, if they're being honest, they will tell you it's very difficult to isolate what contributes to increased collections with absolute certainty. And, you know, the economic cycle plays a role in it. And, you know, revenue estimation is an inexact science, as we know. But it does seem to be something that Republicans are saying, see, we told you we were not doing something imprudent. And, you know, the governor's statements are, well, this shows the fiscal management of the state. And so they're sort of talking past each other.
I think it all depends on how many votes Donald Trump gets in the general election. I think if he wins New Hampshire.
Money's going to rain down on him.
Well, no, I think that if he wins New Hampshire in a big way, that it will affect down ticket races in the Senate and the House, New Hampshire Senate, New Hampshire House. I think if he doesn't do well in New Hampshire and Democrats take control of the Senate and the House, I don't think this is going to be a big issue next cycle. So I think a lot is really riding on November.
Hmm. True. It will be interesting to see. I mean, you look at the way in which sometimes huge turnout, big wins for. You know, we've seen big wins by Republicans in 2010, by Democrats in 2006 and 2008, kind of overwhelm the districting maps just by sheer dint of turnout. That's one thing that, like, I know we're going to be paying attention to here is to look at the implications of, districts in the state Senate that, you know, have been carved in such a way that it has made a steeper climb for Democrats to reclaim the Senate than it might be under a different map.
Yeah, I mean, if Democrats reclaim the Senate – It would mean that the turnout for Democrats would have been just so incredibly massive, maybe even unprecedented. I mean, the way that the districts are set up now, for Democrats to take control of the Senate, it would be a big story, as we like to say.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I think depending on what kind of state legislature is returned to Concord after the election will go a long way to decide how any potential surplus is spent, how much goes in the rainy day fund. There are sort of different thresholds ideologically between the parties about how you use this kind of money, and you know, who knows what will happen to the business tax rates should you go from a Republican legislature to a Democratic legislature.
Well, you know, it did rain last night, and we'll end by talking a little bit about the drought, and you know, it's supposed to be kind of grim weather the next couple of days, but it is, you know, it hasn't been great. The money may have been raining into the state coffers, but it has not been raining on the state's crops. You know, it'll be interesting to see what happens there. It's a rare weekend when we can say sort of pray for rain, but I was visiting my farm stand, they didn't have any carrots because they said the rain was insufficient for that, so... We'll end with a rain dance here, the Friday News Roundup on NHPR. Thanks for joining us.